really think at that point I decided that I didn't like him. And all of our business career was a contest. I never understood why he would be so suspicious of me.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever find out? Did he ever say?
No, he never said. He never said. He never kissed me. I don't remember hugging me. It was just a sad thing. He was a hell fellow well met. Mm-hmm. Probably one of the most popular people that ever lived in that era. A bunch of Christians had been taken fishing and hunting. He didn't know a rifle. But he was just a good poker player, a good pool shooter. And to watch him play.
Wait a minute. How was he with his other children?
He was extremely affectionate with my sister and my younger brother. As far as affectionate as he could be. I was only two, I was three, I was 7 or 9 years. By the time Sidney Jr. came along,
I was just trying to find out why you didn't make out better.
I don't know. That was the thing that's always been a source of my great thing to wish. Because I never could figure out.
And he never told me.
No, and I didn't give a damn because I had to spend all this time by myself, and then I gave him my $100 to one chance he had to be good to me. He didn't. Well, he couldn't buy me an ice cream cone because I knew he didn't have the money.
How about your mother? Didn't she make up for it?
Yes, she did. She trusted me. She respected me. She let me do the shopping. Because even though she and my sister so she would send me to do the shopping, and I would come back and describe to her the judgments that I made, that the 8 o'clock coffee was 23 cents and the boat car was 35, and there was no sense in buying the boat car when you're going to get the same benefit. And the apples were 3 for a dime, and the oranges were 3 for 13, so I bought the apples. I bought this brand, it was A&P. I bought this brand of peanut butter because I looked at the label and it said that this was costing me 3 cents an ounce, and if I went to this other brand, it was going to cost 3.5. So all the way I had these experiences, and so she let me do the shop.
So basically, your mother's support.
Oh, tremendous. Just tremendous. And they had one fight, she walked out. I felt like I looked all over for her. I finally found her sitting at the station. She was just so frustrated. Just so frustrated. She would never break up the family relationship. She was as disappointed and heartbroken as she might have been over what he might have done. What he might have done was never quite clear to me to this day. But knowing the socialists and some of the machinations and people that he associated with, I always wondered what was it for the money, because he was making $75 a week with 4 kids, and actually he was making big commissions.
That was a lot of money.
He was making big commissions, but his partners, this is confidential, the Lichtenstein stole and blind. The Lichtenstein money was making big gifts to the temple, their kids who were in the community. My mother used to say, where is the money? My dad sold National Dairies, New York Milk, the commission was $75. My mother says, where's the money? She says, they're saving it for me. She would say, I want them to save it for me. Let me save it for myself. And Miss Heller Dickens still did this time, as a job this last year, would sit there and would thought with his fingernails and imagine how to connive and what to do. And finally, when we broke up with her, it was a very interesting lawsuit in which Elder Marshall represented them. That name's not known. Elder Marshall was a judge. And as a judge, he, in 1932, was accused by a certain woman of having impregnated her. And he was now on trial, and Sadie was on the jury. And Sadie hung the jury 11 to 1. And so later she said to him, Judge, why did you pick me? He said, because you were a socialist and you were a friend of the other, so there you are. And I knew I would get out of this here. And so now he represents this opposition. When it was over, he said to my parents, you know, I'd like to have a friend of your scum. And he had stolen all this money for us. To get out of his clutches, we, Mr. Leo Langdon and Mr. Louis Kaplan went to Leon Fall. And Leon Fall and Hyman Rogel and Leo Langdon, the three of them signed a $40,000 note.
But so your father was well liked when he goes there. I'm going to lose something in just a second.
I forgot to tell you that I was an original press old newsboy at Pitt. 1936, standing in front of the cathedral, selling the Pittsburgh Press for a nickel if you wanted to take the paper or whatever else you wanted to give. And from that has emanated this incredible program that now raises over $1 million a year. But it was an exciting time. Of course, at Pitt, I also had a wonderful time in so many activities, in politics, in Pi Sigma Alpha, the Honorary Political Science Fraternity. I was in ODK, which is the Honorary Activities Fraternity. And if you look at the 1938 Hall, I had an outstanding position elected to the Hall of Fame. It was quite an exciting time. It was a thoroughly enjoyable experience. And of course, in the meantime, as a senior, as an honors candidate, I had no compulsory class attendance. And that was exciting because I took the constitutional law class because that was a very difficult course that you had to attend in order to master it. And then my other class was a three-credit course at night with the professor of economics who left to become head of an economics department at Yale. There were two of us in the class. In the first semester, we did the history of the theory of wages. And the second semester was the history of the American labor movement. And each semester required reading 15 books. While we were reading those 15 books, I needed one credit. I wrote the history of freedom of the press, and that meant learning how to use the Library of Congress. Then, of course, I had stood for honors in front of the whole political science department. And it was just a thrilling, thrilling time in which I had to read something like 20 books in 15 weeks. It just was so thrilling.
Since you got back to Pitt voluntarily, I want to ask you, was there any special environmental aspect for Jews at that time?
It was exciting because we made our own life out of it. When I graduated, I studied the faculty. There were 980 names. There were three Catholics, the football coach, the debate coach, and a fellow up in the medical school. There were 80 Jewish teachers that I could recognize by name, and there were 900 Protestants. We were not completely comfortable. There was a Pi Lambda, a Phi F fraternity, and a Sammy. So there were three men fraternities, two girls fraternities. Of course, I couldn't afford any of them, so they weren't. So I was a GBI, a goddamn independent. And we made our own life. The fraternities, we had Marshall Goldberg and we had Izzy Weinstock. And, the anti-Semitism existed to the extent that there was a quota of 10 Jews to be given to medical school, and Mr. Paul picked those. Mm-hmm. And my father was instrumental in having some influence with him, so we had a touch of who was out in the field through his kids, and Mr. Paul named at least a half a dozen lawyers, doctors practicing in Pittsburgh. As a result of this relationship. The anti-Semitism, I was the outstanding senior, but they wouldn't let me be this or be that, principally because I was not the family.
Yes.
And because I was Jewish, I think.
It's a combination.
A combination of both. It really, you get to a point where it doesn't matter, because we had I was head of debate, and the guy before me was Jewish, and the guy before him, and the Pitt News, the Jewish people, with a dominant factor. My yearbook was put out by a girl in the year before.
Debate and news and whatever.
That's right. That's right. But Cairo New was strictly for Christian boys going to medical school with C averages, and our boys couldn't get into A's. Mm-hmm. So some of my classmates were.
How'd you feel about that? Did you know? Was it consciously?
We were fighting. My basic fight at that time was against the communists. Mm-hmm. We knew that we couldn't do anything about it. We were in a Presbyterian university, and the Presbyterians have never built a great university. The closest they came is Princeton. Harvard and Yale are Anglican. A Catholic University in Notre Dame was far superior to what it ever was. And so you were pretty much constrained to accept it as it was.
So basically, chemistry acceptance. Basically,
chemistry
acceptance.
Department was all Jewish. Alexander Silverman and Alexander Lowy, preeminent school. Mm-hmm. Strangely enough, you would be interested to know that a significant number of dentists practicing in Manhattan, in Brooklyn, Queens, mm-hmm. in the 50s and the 60s and 70s came to get dental school. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get into New York schools, they came out here. Mm-hmm. Dozens and dozens and dozens of dentists.
Jewish ones.
Jewish, because Pitt at that time did not own the dental school, it was private. So up until Pitt was private, until I said, imagine almost into the 50s, when it became part of the university, paying ownership. And you had Dr. McClellan, who was an anti-Semitic son of Pitt, and ended up selling his dental fraternity's house to Monarch for an exorbitant price. Dr. Sutherland had Izzy Weinstock, good football players, and would never not insist that they go through medical school and dental school, whatever their interests were. Dr. Sutherland respected and honored his commitments to his players, and he brought in Jews. Dr. Carlson did not want Jews, although he was off Braddock. I would ride in from Swissville with him. Carlson was from North Braddock. But finally, in 1928, Chipper Charlie Hyatt, he wanted to recruit him from Uniontown, and Chipper Charlie Hyatt says, you can take me at Pitt on one condition, that you take my two friends, the Cohn boys, mm-hmm. Wilton Cohn and his brother. And they came to Pitt from the furniture business in Uniontown, and that was the first time we had Jewish basketball players. Duquesne, on the other hand, at that time, and back to 1919, was always friendly to the Jews. Mm-hmm. Pop Warner had this one guy that came from Braddock that was Jewish. But we didn't really care. We lived our own life. We attained success as lawyers or doctors or whatever. And none of us had money, so that we all had to take a streetcar to get to school. Whether they came from McKeesport with six guys in a car or walked from school, it really didn't matter.
It was a local streetcar school.
Streetcar school, absolutely. Yeah. There was no question about it. But we were grateful, as I could say. My father could pay $150. I had a scholarship to Bethany College and didn't have the bus fare to go find out where Bethany is. I still haven't seen it. But we had a lot of fun because we made it for ourselves. I got up to the Intercollegiate Conference on Government with 38 schools in Pennsylvania and got elected governor when we were doing a model legislature, unicameral legislature. So I had a big time having an exciting experience. I could imagine that many people thought I was obnoxious because I was so aggressive, but it was a land of survival, and it was part of my, it didn't seem to me like I was hurting anybody. Now I see kids that are in my class and I have no recollection of it. And I almost apologized to them and said, no, you don't owe anybody an apology. Look at all the things you got done, all the fun you had. But we all had to crawl back into the hall because we couldn't stay around. There was no place to eat. There was no place to congregate. And if you didn't belong to a fraternity, you were dead. Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't have a chance to move forward.
So anyway, the environment for Jews in Pittsburgh at Pitt was essentially acceptance.
Acceptance
of the situation.
That's right. Right. But we did have intellectual stimulations. Among our peers, we had no problems if they were non-fraternity.
Okay, Harvard at that time was essentially very anti-Semitic.
Isn't that funny? And we wouldn't have known that. I read about it recently. I don't remember what percentage of my class were Jewish, but the best students were Jews. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what happened to them. I tried to follow them. Many of them were killed in the war. Mm-hmm. The only famous members of my class at Harvard was Senator Johnny Rhodes from Arizona, all that Mamza that became the Secretary of Defense, a Jewish fellow that never wanted to be Jewish.
Weinstein? Or Weinberger?
Weinberger. Casper was
it? Casper.
But did I see him? Did I see any of these guys? No. I had one mistake. I lived in.
Where did Obam go? Did you know Judge Obam?
David Obam had a statement. That's where he was very good.
Oh.
Wonderful. And he's still in Pittsburgh.
He's dead.
He's dead, but she was living in her kids are still here. So he was a nice guy. See, he admired Berger and part of that group. But that was another story I have to tell you on the passage of power. Because in 1943, I was on the Board of Trustees of the United Jewish Federation. The closest person to me in age was Leon Falk. He was 50 and I was 43. I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
Because these other guys had gone off to war. Mr. Hanford was on the West Virginia, made some kind of parts, and he wasn't in Virginia. We fought in the 50s and the day he died. But all these other kids that came back from the service got their shot. But what happened was my father and the only one he would let in of that group, Jaime Rogel and Elmer Hamburg and my old man, they just didn't have room to let these young guys in. So Obam and Mickey Berger never got a chance. They jumped over them. They don't let Herman Feinberg in because he was my father's protege. But they jumped over this group to let my guys in. So there was a hiatus among the guys, Avar Cohen. The only place they had a chance was at the YMHA.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting because that was that 10-year span generation that these older guys never went had an education. So they weren't able to permit Julius Halpern, castigated Bernie on a regular basis at Montreal.
Bernie
on. And my father would be his classmate of mine about it, so I was on a bank board with him and still played on the game. But my father would come back from lunch with Julius Halpern and tell me how he was scattered on this. Well, the son was really helpful. The other year after me, became a Marine captain, was in on the signing of it. He was the exec officer for Halsey on the signing.
Okay, so you didn't experience, you didn't notice the 17th.
I had no time.
So, yeah.
I had no
time. Were you
time.
Only there a year?
That's right. And in fact,
but
we
you
were
did
working.
Get in.
No.
You did get in.
That's it. I got in and on merit. You know, there was a competition.
Yeah, I know.
There were 7,000 students for 500 places this year. 7,000 students for 500 places.
Yeah.
So in those days, it was 2,500 students for maybe 150 spots.
Okay.
No, I was a bright student. I could consider myself bright to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I started to take a master's degree, and I laughed because when it came to taking the basic course in economics,
I already knew it.
One thing that we had in the workman circle was we would go to Sunday school to study value, price, and profit.
Wait a minute, you went to workman's circle?
No, it wasn't. It was a socialist Sunday school over on the James and Forlorn on the north side. And it was run by Emil Lindbaugh, who was the chairman, founder of that Lindbaugh company, and a wonderful human being. And Pete Gygas, who was the manager of his roofing department. And we were studying value, price, and profit, and Karl Marx in economics. So when I got to college, I didn't
know.
I had it already. So to get the master's degree, I had to go back and take Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill and those guys. And so Ferguson was the professor. He said, you ought to teach this course. He said, it was a joke. And the same thing with statistics. When it came to take the course in statistics for the master's degree, it was one hand tied behind my back because I was back in the fifth grade in grade school where we had such incredible... Almost. Don't ask me. I just couldn't catch it. Just couldn't catch it. And then I had the only course that I got a C in college. Was in logic. I always had to laugh at that too, but it was a Presbyterian minister, Mr. Rice, teaching the course, and but after I graduated and I got older, I could understand what they were saying. It was the same thing with the Judaism. 17 years ago, I started to put together a Talmud class that Rabbi Eichleitman is still running.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating because I discovered that all of these things that I often thought about that were part of my philosophy had these origins in Judaism of which I had never studied before. The first question I asked him was, when was the Talmud written? I have no concept that where this whole of Jewish history fit between 100 B.C. and 200 A.D. And then, of course, from there on, it was fascinating because the first year we studied the law, the second year we studied women, the third year we studied ceremonials, and statements were just brilliant. And so it's been an exciting time to discover the reasons why I'm so happy about being Jewish. You know, it's always a thrill, even college.
Okay, a little bit more about your life. You got married,
yeah.
And then...
And my wife's father was...
When did you have children?
What happened? 43, 46,
as a matter of fact. I want you to finish on your
children. We were married in 1940, and my daughter Sally Roth was born in 1943, and my daughter Lily...
Right, with Sally...
Sally Roth, R-O-C-K. She's... I'll tell you a story about her, too. And Hilary Passikoff was born in 1946. November the 23rd. So,
that's two of them.
Two girls, yeah. You know, we had a marvelous time because I always loved children, and they were never a hardship, and it was just a sheer joy. The fact that they were girls and not boys, I'm supposed to have been sick because that didn't bother me either. I was so thrilled to have them. And they were both nice enough to get born without interfering with my going to Pittsburgh Symphony.
Yeah, and they...
One was born on Monday, the other one Friday morning, so I didn't have
to... And they're both in Florida now?
No, Pittsburgh. Sally Rock is a vice president of the Jewish Community Center. She's manager of the temps business for Lycan. She's got a very responsible job. She has her two children. Steve is going to graduate from Penn State next month, and Wendy's a sophomore at Miami University of Ohio.
Stephen
Rock at the BDM. Wendy is Weinstein. She studied Japanese. All three of my granddaughters' favorite subject is math, and all three of my granddaughters major in business.
Mm-hmm.
Wendy spent two summers in Spain. She's mixed in Israel, so she's now fluent in Hebrew and Spanish. Studying Japanese and English. She's more than a linguist. She's like real overachiever. Mm-hmm. And Steve's former president of his fraternity, and they specialize in going to Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and raising money for cancer research. Mm-hmm. My thrill with my girls, among many, many others, and they've been a source of great pleasure, is the fact that both of them studied in fields in which they had to do something for someone else to make a living. Sally went to Syracuse as a speech therapy major. Married Fred, who was president of his fraternity while she was president of her sorority, and they met at a Seder. And he's got wonderful parents in Rochester, New York. So they've been married for 25 years. Started at Kent State and ended up at Duquesne and ended up going on the Hill in a home care program for Montefiore because my children were both born colorblind. They never were. This is one of the great pleasures that the black never bothered them, never, they were never afraid. And this to me is the essence of human freedom, to live without fear. I learned a long time ago. I activate my favorite song. But I've always thought that Alan was stupid. At age 4, that they worked for 65 and died at 66. And really never understood that life was on the clock. My God, that wasn't going to happen to me. I was going to retire at 50 and spend the rest of my life doing mitzvah. So I went to 55 and retired 5 years later.
Good. And you've got to just exactly where I want you to be now. Before we leave today, I want a summary of your business career in the workforce. in other words, the laundry business and the laundry associations.
I don't think that can be done.
Well, I want to.
I think you ought to say.
Well, you can start on.
I'll start on it because here's the whole history of it here.
I want to hear it.
I hear you.
Tell me what's in there.
Yeah,
what are you showing?
Well, this is the Young President's Organization describing my business career, because this was put together by my wife. And what it involved was this. First of all, I started out on a truck in the industrial laundry business in 1931, working 6 in the morning to 6 at night. And then during the summer, I would work in the laundry, and I learned all the processes, pressing the garments at 110 degrees all the way through. And by the time I came back out of Harvard, I became an outside salesman, the first one in the history of this particular company, and only the third college person to ever be in the industrial laundry industry. These were former truck drivers and other things. They went to Washington in 1933 to write an NRA code for wiping rights, and 6 of them, including 2 men from Chicago, 1 from Youngstown, 2 from New York, 1 from Cincinnati, and my father, and they decided to write a code for industrial laundry instead.
Not wiping rights.
And so they went out and started this concept of salvaging what a truck would stand outside the Ford Motor Plant there at Norwood Boulevard and pick up the dirty overalls one Monday and bring them back the next Monday. That wasn't my father's idea. He started when the store went broke in 1924. He went out on the road selling overalls, like you people see the bib overalls today. That was his business. He sold overalls up and down the whole East Coast, to National Dairy, to Johnstown, all these small towns. And he was a thorough student of the milk industry. And incidentally, he was responsible for the founding of Pittsburgh Milk, which then became a very big thing called Country Bell. And my father was a very severe, very significant student of the milk industry because of his whole history. He started the concept, but those days they were washing the overalls. So then they started to rent. My father pioneered the rental of pants and shirts, 1937, first time. So that this was a pioneering effort. My father was on the national board of this group and thought that they should have a magazine. So my sister created the first magazine on the floor of our host of 5711 Northumberland Street. That magazine now earns over $500,000 a year for the industry. It's a magnificent issue I just put out this morning. All started from these ideas. He had so many creative, original ideas. Long before his time, he died in 1960. He had created 3 funds at the Pittsburgh Foundation in honor of Harvey Thorpe for saving this eye. He put away an ophthalmic fund until such time as the Montefiore Hospital became affiliated with the University of Pittsburgh Medical School, at which time he wanted that money back to be put into the Pitt. We're talking now 1950. He was the fellow that...
Say which eye? Who's that?
I have a chorioretinitis.
So your father... Your father did treat you decently.
Oh, he did all the manifestations of being a great father, but they didn't include...
Affection.
I'm sorry. I thought you didn't catch that the first time.
I caught it.
We did a lot of things.
It was your eye.
He was so proud of me, but he would never, say it. So anyhow, that was one. The second fund was a fund in honor of the YMHA until such time as it merged with the Irene Kaufman settlement, in which case he wanted that money to be put in the Pitt Library. So the Pitt Library now has a $65,000 endowed fund in favor of the spoken record as a teaching tool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got 2,000 titles. Then he wanted to preserve the socialist philosophy, and I couldn't convince him that he couldn't use that terminology, so he accepted American and European Economic History. So now there's a $20,000 endowed fund at the Pitt Library, and several hundreds and hundreds of books that manifest the history of American labor movement, European labor movement, women in the workplace, and all these other things that go into making for democratic socialism in a better world. And this has been a hard time. In the business world, it was incongruous that this socialist would become such an incredible success in an industrial economy, capitalistic economy. But he was such a fabulous salesman and so creative and imaginative that this business grew to be a very successful thing. And in 1946, when we gained control of the business, without money, I was then a vice president and sales manager. In 1950, he let me become president. We eventually ended up with $7 million a year in volume and 400 employees. He went to Florida back in the 40s and with a former partner of his, developed a truck driver into a substantial industrial laundry business called New Way in Opa-locka, which is in Dade County.